Now, when you talk about the bigger picture, what was the Trilateral Commission? It was the leading bankers and financiers and their think tanks in Europe, the United States, and Japan. And they put forward a perspective of how to control the world. And their perspective started from the traditional standpoint of British geopolitics, which is you must always have an enemy image because you need to have wars and confrontations, little wars, proxy wars, false flags to get wars, and so on. What was their goal? It was depopulation. It was control of the world's resources, use of the international banking system, the International Monetary Fund, the Bank for International Settlements, and so on, to keep poorer nations poor, so they would be sources of cheap raw materials and cheap laborers, which later became the World Trade Organization, which argued for doing away with national economies, that is, getting rid of sovereignty, so that no nation has a control over its own credit system, banking system, or trading system. And we've been moving in that direction successively.
With the COVID-19 virus crisis and the number of casualties with the flu, if you have not been looking at C60 as a means to significantly improve your immunities by now, you should be. Here's why. First, a strong and healthy immune system is your body's first defense, and for those with a strong immune system, your body will adequately fight viruses without medical intervention. Second, C60 is safe as long as you are taking high quality C60 with no added fillers or solvents. Third, C60 is the best means of removing free radicals from your body that exists. It's at least 200 times better at this function than vitamin C and any other antioxidant. Fourth, as Dr. Chu Li stated on a previous show, COVID-19 creates massive amounts of free radicals, which is causing organ failure for those with weaker immune systems. So now it becomes clear you need the best free radical fighter that exists, and that is C60 with black seed oil and curcumin. Why black seed oil and curcumin? Because these two ingredients are the absolute best at supporting C60 to fight viruses and to improve your immune system. Go to sarahwestall.com/shop and learn more about why this formula is so powerful for building your immunities. And it's now available in gel capsules and by diffuser for more serious needs. Be sure to read the research and, of course, use the current coupons to save money when you buy. Patrons also receive a 10% discount. You can find that code at patreon.com/sarahwestall. Remember, keeping you and your family safe is the most important thing you can do. Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I have Harley Schlinger coming back, and we are going to talk about all things geopolitical and financial and how this coronavirus is fitting in. This is a very serious situation. What's going on, as everybody knows, and we're going to talk about how they're using the coronavirus. It's really a level 2 pandemic on what the health authorities in the United States put together before this whole thing went down. And based on the real numbers that are coming out, it's really at a level 2, but they're implementing level 5 procedures and beyond. Level 2, all you do is the voluntary, it's voluntary quarantine for the groups that are at the highest risk, and everybody else you leave alone. They say they do not recommend masks. They do not recommend mass vaccinations. They do not recommend contact tracing, no lockdowns. All that stuff is off the table for a level 2 pandemic, and these numbers hit squarely at a level 2. In fact, they're doing things even backwards, where they're not even protecting the most vulnerable, as we all know, in my state, where they're sending the most vulnerable people in the elderly home are getting the sick sent to them. So we're doing everything backwards. But the point is that they're purposely causing these bankruptcies, the very elite, not the average politician, probably maybe they're snowed and manipulated, I don't know. But it's a convenient tool to be able to take down the economy when the economy was going to crash anyways. It was ready to implode. And they're using the coronavirus to take it down. And then they're going to be able to go in and buy all these assets and have real wealth. They're sitting on a house of cards of BS with nothing as far as the fiat money. And they want the real wealth behind. They want to get it all. And they are going to move in. And these bankruptcies are, they want the little guy gone. And they want to take over as much as they can. And they will. And we talk about who the true enemy is. There's a lot of disinformation out there. China really isn't our true enemy. They are doing some things, you know, like troop buildup on Indian reservations and various things. But we should be wanting no wars, and we want cooperation around the world. If you don't have cooperation around the world, you're talking about wars. And we're going to talk all about this in this interview. It's really some important, and this is really important that people understand where we need to direct our energy to, what we need to direct our focus, and how we need to support this. Because without this, Donald Trump, without the support of the actions that'll help our country flourish, he won't be able to do any actions that'll help. And he's also being pushed in directions that, quite frankly, don't make sense. And we all see it, and we're people who are analyzing this are a little frustrated. We need to support him in the ways, like what he ran on, what his initial goals were. He needs to get back to a lot of that, and we talk about it. And I want to let you know, before we get into this interview, I am going to be speaking at Freedom Fest this year. It's the week of July 13th through that's the Monday, and then through that Friday. I'll be speaking on the Wednesday at 4:00. But I have a link below if you are interested in going to Freedom Fest. I have a $50 off coupon so that you can go there and save a little bit of money. So, and if you do go there and you're a listener of mine, make sure you come and see me and say hi. And again, I'll be speaking on Wednesday at 4:00. So look for the link below to save money. Make sure you use that coupon. And I also want to tell you that the C60 lotion and the face cream and lotion, what I'm learning that is if you get a burn, so if you go someplace on the 4th of July or you lay out in the sun too much and your skin burns, this is a phenomenal lotion for sunburn because it heals your skin. It gets rid of the free radicals. It sucks it up. So I highly recommend looking at that for before you go on vacation so that you have something like this handy for you. And you can get that at my shop at sarahwessel.com/shop. So let's get into this important interview with Harley Schlanger. Hi, Harley. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Sarah. Good to see you again.
You know, it's been, 3 months since we talked last time. It's time to get you on and talk about what's really going on behind the scenes here. And I think that I know that there's a lot of significant developments that we need to be talking about. And I also want to touch on, you know, the coronavirus, how that's being used. But even more importantly, I want to talk about the big picture, who the players are, and what they are really trying to do, how China and Russia and Israel and India all fit into this. Because I think there is this huge disinformation campaign trying to confuse people on what is really going on and who's in bed with these globalists who want to depopulate and take over the world. So first of all, can you talk about who these globalists are, you know, the central bankers, who want to depopulate and are in powerful positions behind the coronavirus, behind the dollar reset, behind all this Green New Deal? Who are those people and what are their agenda?
Well, you're right to say you have to start with the big picture, because what happens is people get caught up in the small back and forth little dots they try to connect. And as a result, they get thrown off. They get diverted. Now, what we've been doing for 50 years at the LaRouche Movement is tracing the networks behind the scenes, what they think and what their intention is. One of the first things we did was when Jimmy Carter won the Democratic nomination in 1976, we wrote a book called Carter and the Party of International Terrorism. And this was the first major book that was put out on the Trilateral Commission. Now, when you talk about the bigger picture, what was the Trilateral Commission? It was the leading bankers and financiers and their think tanks in Europe, the United States, and Japan. And they put forward a perspective of how to control the world. And their perspective started from the traditional standpoint of British geopolitics, which is you must always have an enemy image because you need to have wars and confrontations, little wars, proxy wars, false flags to get wars, and so on. You need it also to feed the military-industrial complex, because the defense budget is a very large portion of expenditure of at least some of the nations of the world, the bigger nations. And so who was it they deployed to do that in the Carter administration? Zbigniew Brzezinski, working directly under David Rockefeller. So when you talk about the big picture, and I'm going back to this because we're dealing with the same thing today, 40-something years later, that we were exposing back in 1976. What was their goal? It was depopulation. It was control of the world's resources, use of the international banking system, the International Monetary Fund, the Bank for International Settlements, and so on, to keep poorer nations poor so they would be sources of cheap raw materials and cheap labor. And that's when they began the whole series of globalist free trade agreements, which was under, at that time, GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which later became the World Trade Organization, which argued for doing away with national economies, that is, getting rid of sovereignty, so that no nation has a control over its own credit system, banking system, or trading system. And we've been moving in that direction successively since 1971, but the Carter administration was a key point, a breakpoint. Brzezinski had a strategy, which came from someone named Bernard Lewis, who was a top British intelligence operative, which was called the Arc of Crisis. You take the band of countries under the Soviet Union, because then, remember, it was the middle of the Cold War. You take those nations and you deploy Islamic fundamentalists that will then go into Russia and into China to destabilize and defeat those nations. And what did we get from that? We had the Iran situation when Carter was president. We had the beginnings of the Afghan war with the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, where they were suckered in by operations run by the United States, by Brzezinski. And since that time, we've pretty much been at war in the Middle East. And this has defined the major geopolitical relationships between the U.S., Europe, Russia, China, Japan, and India, the major powers in the world. Now, what changed? Ronald Reagan tried to change it, because Reagan, despite his reputation as an anti-communist, which was real, he was an anti-communist, but he didn't want war. And that's when we first had a major influence, when LaRouche was brought in by Ronald Reagan to negotiate with the Soviets for the Strategic Defense Initiative, so that we could share a technology that would put an end to the use of nuclear weapons. And that's when the Get LaRouche Task Force started, and it was started by Kissinger and was assigned to a man who was pretty much unknown then, Robert Mueller, who became the head of the Get LaRouche Task Force that ended up putting LaRouche in prison. After Reagan, virtually no president stood up against this until Trump's election. So we've been going for a pretty much unbroken period of time where a gang of globalists who run the central banks of the world, the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve, these are private banks. They're not government agencies. They use the governments to provide credit to the private sector banks, the big banks, the money center banks, and to starve the rest of the economy. And the key for our discussion here is that the last 50 years, we've seen a shift of the U.S. labor force from goods production, from work in transportation, utilities, construction, manufacturing, mining, to services and consumer and entertainment economy. Now, some people like that. They think it's good. They think it's more freedom. The reason it's not more freedom is people have less money. You used to make more money with manufacturing jobs than you do today in the so-called gig economy. And so we've seen a shift away from real production and a speculative economy. And who controls the casino? The same people in the central banks, the Rothschilds, the Lazard Freres, the Rockefellers, the whole group of people from Deutsche Bank, BNP Paribas, the major French bank. Also, don't forget the Netherlands. They're extremely important in terms of banking because it was originally the Anglo-Dutch system that set up the first central bank, the Bank of England. So if you understand that, then you ask the question, well, are these guys crazy? Why are they tearing down the advanced physical economy in the Western countries? Well, because they don't like that. Because an advanced economy based on science and technology tends to orient toward democracy and elevating people. And they don't want people elevated. They want to keep people ignorant, backwards, and fighting so they can increase their share of a shrinking pie. They would rather have a bigger piece of a shrinking pie than have a growing pie where everybody gets more. That's the bigger picture.
Where does the Queen fit into this? The City of London and the Queen?
Well, the British monarchy that was set up in 1700 was essentially a merger of some European nobility and a handful of people from Britain. It really started a little earlier with William and Mary in 1688, the so-called Glorious Revolution. And one of the key people in that was Thomas Hobbes and also John Locke, who asserted this idea of the Hobbes talked about the power of the state, the Leviathan, having total power. Now, John Locke said, no, you have to have contracts. But he wasn't opposed to total power being in the hands of the monarchy, because John Locke served on the board of the shipping companies and the slave-owning companies that were part of the monarchy. The monarchy that was brought in with the current one, the Windsors, was, you know, a lower-level grouping, but they were essentially run by what was called the Privy Council. And if you look at the history of the United Kingdom, of Great Britain, what you see is that it built an empire based on looting poor countries. And their greatest regret was losing the American colonies. They never got over it. And they've done everything they can since our successful revolution, not just to win us back, but to destroy the ideas of the American system. Because the American system is based on a system of merit, of progress, not control by an oligarchy. And that's the essential difference, because an oligarchy doesn't want change. They want to keep people in the basement and ignorant and fighting with each other. Whereas the American system was based on the idea that if you have talent, you have skills, you can do something, we're going to open the door for you to do that and bring that to our country. And that's how we grew as a power. And one other point here, because this is really a contentious point when you talk to the neoliberals, the American system was not anti-government. It was in favor of a government which acts for the general welfare against private interests. You read the Constitution, you read the arguments and the debates, that's what they kept saying. And our best presidents always understood that. The Federal Reserve System is a system that it gives all the power to the most wealthy, the most powerful, and doesn't allow for the entrepreneurial spirit. Whereas what Franklin did, Ben Franklin and his protege, Alexander Hamilton, was set up a credit system that said, if you have a useful idea, the Society for Useful Manufacturers is what Hamilton set up. If you have a useful idea, we'll fund it. You know, maybe some of these ideas won't pan out, but the ones that do will increase the wealth available to everyone. And that was the whole idea of the American system, as opposed to a British system which says, we're better by birth and we're going to rule. And we may let a few of you come up and join us, but the rest of you are going to live lives of short, unhappy, miserable lives.
So now, are the British behind this whole globalist depopulation, control the world through the Green New Deal and this central bankers coup that we've talked about in many shows?
Well, it's not just the British. And let me just say, because I have a lot of friends in England, it's not the English people either. It's the oligarchy, the City of London, the people who think they're better by virtue of who they know and who their mother and father is. Now, what they've done successfully after the American Revolution, look, they didn't think the Americans could beat them. And what actually enabled our revolution to succeed was not just the intelligence and commitment of our founding fathers, but it was a global movement. The French participated, the Russians, the Swedes, the Austrians. They formed something called the League of Armed Neutrality to say to the British, don't go too far because we're going to put an embargo on you. And so it was a global movement. that the British never forgot. But what they did after that was to figure out how can they subvert any country that tries to adopt the model of the American system. Because that's what started happening. The American system was so successful that at our centennial in 1876, people from all over the world, from governments, came to Philadelphia to the World's Fair. And they saw steam engines, they saw factories, they saw the tremendous explosion of creative activity that was increasing the wealth of the United States. And they said, how do we get in on this? And there were Americans who were sent to countries like Japan, to a man named E. Peschein Smith went to Japan. They went to Germany. That's what Bismarck did. He implemented the American system, which made Germany suddenly develop as an economy. Italy had a grouping, France, and so on. So the British saw this as a threat. So that's when they launched recruitment around the financial centers of the world. And they did it through things like Cecil Rhodes, for example, the Rhodes Scholarship. That's a special fund to recruit Americans to become pro-British. And I don't mean pro-English, I mean pro-British system. They set up think tanks, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and you know who their partner in the United States was? The Council on Foreign Relations. You know, they set up broader connection like the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, and so on, where they recruited the oligarchs of Europe. They recruited some people from Asia, but not many. They still saw much of Asia as a colonial area to be looted. But their main target was, how do you get the United States on the side of the Anglo-Americans, on the side of the British? And that's what geopolitics is about. The idea that the greatest threat to the freedom that the British have and that supposedly the Americans have is if you had an alliance between France, Germany, and Russia that used high-speed rail to control not just Europe, but Eurasia, trading zones. Why would that be important? Because the British ruled the world through their navy and the control of ports. So geopolitics was, how do we pit these countries against each other? And that's what World War I was about. Sure, the Archduke of Austria was shot and killed at Sarajevo, but you already had the troops mobilizing. The whole goal of World War I was to make sure France and Russia fought against Germany. And they, after the war, they punished Germany at Versailles and created a situation where when Germany started rebuilding, it was immediately again seen as a threat by France and Russia. And so World War II, the seeds of World War II came out of World War I. We had the whole 20th century dominated by this. You know, in 1956, the British and the French and the Israelis, because Israel was a part of this, Israel was created out of a 1917 agreement by the British monarchy to establish a Jewish state when there were hardly any Jews in Palestine. We can go into that more if you want, because that's important for people to understand. But what was done was that the British intended to use these wars to bring the United States in on the British side. And Eisenhower wasn't committed to that. So when Britain, France, and Israel invaded Egypt over the Suez Crisis in 1956, Eisenhower threatened sanctions against London. He said, we're not going to go to war for you. The same way Franklin Roosevelt had told Churchill, Americans are not dying in the Second World War to restore the British Empire. So we had some presidents who understood that. Kennedy understood it completely. Kennedy understood the British role in colonization, in control of banking, and everything he was doing was trying to create a basis for America to provide leadership to the colonial nations and the rest of the world, like the French, against the British. And that's why he was moving against the Federal Reserve System and against the CIA. Remember, the CIA was set up out of the OSS by British intelligence in World War II. And Kennedy was killed for what he was trying to do. He was the last president who really stood up.
So, yeah, Kennedy was the last president. And then we have Trump, who is pushing back. We've seen some elements of pushback. But there are, okay, so we have the city of London and the central bankers. But there are different ideas of how China fits into this, how the Bolsheviks and the Zionists fit into this. And there's disinformation campaigns and psyops to confuse everybody so that we don't know who to support and how to protect ourselves. Because we are in the situation, we're being attacked, and they're trying to misdirect us to look at other, to go after other areas so that we don't protect ourselves properly. So can you give us context of how the City of London are using these various groups against us, and who isn't really against? I mean, talk about some of these psyops and who these groups are and how they're being used.
Well, this goes back to the question of sovereignty. You know, our Constitution calls for the United States to be a sovereign democratic republic, not a democracy, but a republic with institutions of self-government, where the people decide through the Congress what's in our interests. And the president has a special role in that as an executive to make sure that the people's will is followed through. And this is something that President Trump is very aware of. We've had very few presidents who've actually functioned on that level. Now, the problem you have is that if you realize that in a world economy where, whether we like it or not, it is a global economy, that doesn't mean it has to be the system of globalization, because the system of globalization was specifically set up to benefit the global corporate cartels. You have the food cartel, you have Big Pharma, you have the raw material cartels, the energy cartels, you have the banking and finance cartels, the insurance cartels, and these are all interlocked. Many of them include key people from the City of London, who are members of the House of Lords, the Privy Council, who serve under the Queen. And they then are appointed to set up think tanks and boards of intelligence operations. This is where British intelligence recruits from the aristocracy. Now, the way this thing then works is that you have on two or three levels. This is something, by the way, George Orwell really understood in 1984. If you can have people fighting each other and not knowing the cause of the animosity, why did this start? It's like the Hatfields and McCoys. No one knew who fired the first shot, but they knew the Hatfields hated the McCoys and the McCoys hated the Hatfields. This is what the Soviet Union became for the United States. Roosevelt tried to change that, not because he liked Stalin, but because he knew that once we entered the era of nuclear weapons, that we could destroy the world if we have a war. So the question was, could the wartime alliance be continued with the Russian people, not necessarily with Stalin? And when Roosevelt died, Churchill swooped in and made sure that Truman, through the CIA connection to the British and others, supported a Cold War. Now, look, Russian communism was horrible. And it fell because it was horrible. It took a long time. You know, these things take time for people to finally realize that they were born for something which is better than what they're living under. Similarly, the Chinese communism under Mao Zedong and the Cultural Revolution was horrifying, brutal. You know, both Stalin and Mao killed millions of people. Now, a government that does that can't stay in power indefinitely unless it's planning to continue killing millions of people. And what we saw happen with the Soviet Union was that once under Reagan, the United States had an economic boom based on science and technology, mostly in the defense sector, but in other areas, applications of that in other areas. The Russian scientists realized they couldn't keep up. And they either had to go to war in the 1980s or they would eventually lose. And this is what LaRouche told them. In 1984, Lin said, your system has only 5 more years. And he was right. When it fell, this is where the real problem comes in. What would we do with a nuclear power that has a scientific cadre, that has industry, even though it's not that efficient, but also has a lot of poor, angry people? Do we go in and loot them? Or do we go in and work with them and help them to take what they have and build on it so they can become trading partners? That was the issue in 1989, 1990. And what happened is the British, through Oxford and the City of London, working through people like Robert Strauss, remember him, the Democratic Party fixer, who was Aiken Gump Law Firm, very highly connected in Washington, Strauss and his guys brought in people like Jeffrey Sachs, Larry Summers, people from Harvard, to go over and set up a banking system that favored the Russian oligarchs who were part of the KGB. And they looted Russia. Bill Browder, the famous guy behind the Magnitsky Act, he stole billions of dollars from the Russians. And what they kept doing was they took over the raw materials. They took over the industry. They dismantled it. And the situation got worse and worse and worse in Russia. And that's when Putin came in. And Putin came in on the back of a nationalist religious sentiment that said, we're going to be a great power again, but to do it, we have to break with this policy of looting us. Now, a similar thing happened in China, not quite the same, because the communists still have power in China. But the communists realized that they were falling further and further behind. Now, this is where the globalists come in. The globalist policy for Russia was to destroy it, take away all the raw materials, all the money, and put in place a bunch of thieving oligarchs who are dependent on the city of London, Paris, and New York for their connections. The Chinese didn't let that happen. But what the Chinese, the way they were brought in, was the globalists said, we'll let you come into the World Trade Organization, and we'll move our industries to China to take advantage of your cheap labor. And so this was the outsourcing under Clinton, Bush, and then Obama, where American corporations moved to China. Remember, under NAFTA, they moved to Mexico at first, but then they started going to Honduras, Guatemala, then they went to China, Southeast Asia, where they could get cheap labor. And this is how China was built up as an economic power. And initially, it was with American know-how. But the Chinese were smart. They developed their own technical capabilities, their universities. They sent students by the thousands to the United States to learn. So they don't have to steal as much intellectual property anymore because they have their own development. In fact, we may be stealing more from China than they're stealing from us. Now, to take these two cases, Trump came in and said two things that were really significant. One, let's become friends with Russia. Let's work with the Russians. We have mutual interests, fighting terrorism, certain other kinds of things. Let's work with Russia to do that. And that's what Russiagate was about, to stop Trump from breaking with the Bush and Obama policy consensus. On China, he was a little tougher on China when he was running for president. But once he became president, he met with Xi Jinping a couple times. He liked him. And he said, let's work together on this. And what did they talk about? They talked about a trade deal. And Trump correctly said that he didn't blame China for taking all the American corporations. That was our fault for doing it. But now let's get a fair deal, a fair trade deal. And that's what was in process when the whole coronavirus thing broke out. And all of a sudden, China became enemy number one. But the president was right in his dealings both with Russia and China. And that's why the oligarchy did everything they could to smear and slander Trump using the media, using the Mueller investigation, the corrupt networks in the FBI and the CIA, because they wanted to pull off a coup against Trump, because he was shifting away from this British global policy.
Now, the British global policy, their idea to usher in this Green New Deal, the digital one world currency, the carbon, taking over budgets for governments, which we've talked about. And if people haven't seen it, they should go back and watch some of those shows. They're just fantastic the way that you've educated our listeners on what the central bankers are wanting to do. But now, where do they want to run that out of? And how does that work with Russia, Israel, and China? Because people are concerned, and my understanding is they initially wanted to take over China and kind of have China be the place they wanted to run things out of. But are they looking at that they changed their mind on that, and now they're wanting to run things out of where, and have they changed their mind?
Well, let's start with their ultimate goal. The ultimate goal of these policy elites, going back to people like Bertrand Russell, the Churchill crowd, Marlborough, Churchill goes back to the Glorious Revolution of 1688 in terms of his family. Now, their whole view is that there are too many people in the world. and that means there are too many people to feed, too many people making demands on small raw materials and so on. So we need to wipe them out. I mean, Bertrand Russell actually said, war has been disappointing in its ability to limit population. A great plague every generation or so would be much better. So this is a longstanding British policy that goes back to Thomas Malthus, the original Malthusian. And this is what all these bankers today represent. You're referring to the talk we had after the Jackson Hole, Wyoming meeting last August, where bankers came together around Mark Carney, who at the time was the head of the Bank of England. He's now the head of the Green New Deal at the United Nations. And he works very closely with Michael Bloomberg, that corrupt little bastard in New York. Bloomberg is one of the big pushers for a Green New Deal, the Davos billionaires. Now, the other person was Larry Fink of BlackRock. And at Jackson Hole, they said, we need a regime change in finance. And what did they mean? They said, we can no longer allow governments to make budget policy because governments are susceptible to constituency pressure. In other words, governments do try to keep people alive. And their policy was not to keep people alive. So they said, we have to have the central banks not just do monetary policy, but fiscal policy. And this is what they're trying to do. Take control of credit so that sovereign governments no longer can respond if their people say, look, we want infrastructure, we want healthcare, we want food, we want good jobs. So what? The bankers need something else. And what do they need? They've created a system of trillions of dollars of worthless paper, collateralized loan obligations, collateralized debt obligations. You and I and Ellen Brown talked about some of this last time we talked. You know, it's a debt overhang. One of my friends once described it as a 2-pound puppy with a 300-pound tick sucking its blood. You know, you've got this incredible parasitical system which does not allow credit to go into production, into the mom and pop shops, into the entrepreneurial startups, into rebuilding our manufacturing base. They can't get credit. But Larry Fink and Carney and others said, let's use the Green New Deal to say we're not going to fund anything that produces a carbon footprint. In other words, no steel production, no machine tool production. No aerospace, none of that. Just solar, wind, subsistence farming. And how many people can that sustain? Not a whole lot. And what they said then is to make sure this is done properly, you have to have, they didn't use the term dictatorial, but that's what they meant, dictatorial control over credit, which would mean no credit for farmers, the family farmer. No credit for small business. Drive them all out of business and make them peons who have to crawl before this system. In the same way, the African people were made peons by the colonial system there. That's what their intention.
They're well into that process right now. We're seeing that unfold. And they're talking about doing the reset 2021. That's they're actually coming out with the timing on this. That's why I want to get this big picture figured out so we know, because there's so much disinformation going on right now on who our enemies are and what, because they're trying to deflect us and get us looking in other directions.
Let me just fill out the big picture, because this is what people have to understand. An economy is not about money. Money is not a good measure of economic value. Economic value is productivity, the units of production one individual employed in production can turn out compared to a previous system. Productivity increase is where wealth is created. And that's largely the application of science to create new technologies that cheapen the cost of production. That's what infrastructure is, a platform of infrastructure where you can move goods more rapidly and more safely, where you can produce more energy and so on, where you can manage water resources well. This is what is the source of wealth. And where does that come from? It comes from the mind. Now, the argument of the oligarchs is that they can come up with a speculative system that can produce wealth more rapidly than that. You know, this is the old, you know, turning straw into gold of the alchemists. You know, if you can come up with a system that can produce wealth more quickly, why doesn't everyone adopt that? Well, because it's not real wealth. It's paper. It's notations on a computer. You know, if you look at the stock bubble, you can have a stock market appreciate 200, 300, 400% in a year and then get wiped out in 5 minutes by computerized trading. That's not real wealth. Real wealth are the things that enable us to transform nature, to increase the potential for a growing number of people to live in a better standard of living.
Can I make a little point here? Wouldn't you say that's sure. why Main Street can be operating different than Wall Street? Main Street can flourish and actually have a healthy environment separate from Wall Street, sort of. I mean, they're dependent on them, but it's really not the same ecosystems.
Well, today that's changed because everything is tied up with the too big to fail banks.
That's the problem. It shouldn't be, because Main Street is real wealth. The other one is, but it's exactly. They're so dependent on it that it doesn't work. Go ahead.
Exactly. Go back to 2008. We forecast this was going to happen because they created these financial instruments called mortgage-backed securities, where if you had the credit, you could go in and buy up tons of these things that depended on people paying their mortgages. Now, once these were created, brokerage firms sold them to their trusting clients, you know, basically the suckers, because it was clear that the housing bubble was going to pop. And when it popped, what happened? Did the people who ran the system pay? No, they got bailed out. But the people who bought the houses that were overpriced, the people who had these mortgage-backed security bonds and their 401k plans and their pension plans, they lost. And why did that happen? Because in 1999, through work by Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, Bill Clinton, Phil Graham, and others, the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed. The Glass-Steagall Act was put in by Franklin Roosevelt, one of the first things he did in 1933, to separate commercial banking from investment banking, which simply meant that no commercial bank could take its investor, its clients' deposits and savings and speculate with it. That protected them. But once you lifted that wall of separation, which happened with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, now investment bankers could go in and grab up depositors' savings, their business accounts, and so on. And so when that was lost, who lost? The depositors and the savers. But the swindlers got bailed out. Now, did we change that in 2008, 2009? No, because we had Barack Obama, who was completely controlled by this gang of banksters. And what Obama did is work with Barney Frank and Chris Dodd, two Wall Street guys, to draft the Dodd-Frank bill, which basically made stealing legal. And they rigged the rules so that if you were a big bank with hundreds of lawyers and accountants, you could comply with the new regulations. If you were a Main Street bank, a small regional bank, a local farm bank, you couldn't do it. And then what happened is, where did the credit go? The credit went to the money center banks, and the little guys were left with the deposits of their customers, and they couldn't compete. And so a new bubble was created by Obama, which was called the Obama recovery. And remember, in 2016, Trump kept saying, this is not a real recovery. He was right. Then he got in. And one of the things he said during his campaign is he would restore Glass-Steagall. Well, he should have done it, because without Glass-Steagall, he became dependent for the economy to function, and function in a euphemistic way, for the stock market to grow. He needed to give the speculators all the credit they wanted. And so while he was trying to get money into manufacturing, he was trying to use the trade deal with China to bring back American firms. He tried to use the tax policy to do that. None of those things worked the way they should have, because he had to deal with a Congress which is completely owned and controlled by these oligarchs. And so we were left with a situation in the summer of last year where we were headed toward a new crash. And you and I did a program on this, I think, last August, where I talked about the fact that this is ripe to crash because there's a liquidity crunch, because the leverage is so great and the actual real assets are so small. And so it blew up in the middle of September when the Federal Reserve jumped in on the 24-hour overnight repo markets to cover $20 billion, $50 billion, $70 billion, $120 billion a night to banks to loan to zombie corporations that weren't making enough money to cover the interest on their debt. But what happened? Those corporations, because of this repo money, were allowed to keep writing new bonds. Almost 50% of corporate bonds in the last 2 years are now at junk bond status. And what's happening to them? The Federal Reserve is buying them to keep the bonds on the books of banks while they're holding up corporations.